Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History.
On December 14th, we mark the bicentennial of the death of George Washington, America's first and still greatest hero, a person recognized long ago as being first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, which pretty much sums up Washington's professional life, his accomplishments, and his reputation. While we know the facts of Washington's life, what he accomplished on the battlefield and as the nation's first president, but just how did it come to pass that he would become the most prominent of all American heroes? Here to explore that question with us is Paul Longmore, professor of history at San Francisco State University and the author of The Invention of George Washington, published by the University of California Press. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Right. Let me begin right with the title of your book, because you write in the preface that the title, The Invention of George Washington, has three significations. So let me list each one and then have you explain them.
Okay.
In the first, you say, and I'm quoting here, it refers to the historical process by which the revolutionary generation of Americans made an individual leader into a heroic personage who incarnated their Republican and nationalist beliefs. What does that mean?
Well, part of the revolutionary process at the beginning and then throughout the history, not only of the war, but of the making of the new nation, was the attempt to establish and institutionalize in a permanent way the values and the new identity of the revolutionaries. I think that, in fact, George III, as the king, was not just the ruler of colonial British Americans, but was also an incarnation, a living embodiment of the values of a monarchical society, of the traditional hierarchical order, and of the British nation. And in a remarkable way, and very quickly, it came as a surprise to me studying this, Washington was the substitute that they put up on the monument to replace George III. One George supplanted another. This was not Washington's own intent initially, or his own conscious doing in the first stage. This was something that he was used for by his fellow revolutionaries, his fellow Americans, as they were now redefining themselves. So that the process of making him into a heroic monument for them was a way of telling themselves who they now were and what their new political values were, what their new identities were. It was a marking, a symbolic embodying of their transformation from British to American, from monarchists to Republicans, from British patriots to American nationalists.
So this was, in a sense, a public act, a public creation here by this first generation of Americans.
Yes, exactly.
And how exactly was it done? I mean, you've explained what it was, but how was it done?
Well, the specific ways in which they did it were, involved the ways they talked about him. The very phrase "father of his country" had been a phrase used to refer to the king, although all male leaders were, in a sense, fathers. But that monarchical phrase that had been applied to the king was then applied to Washington fairly early on in the war. The celebration of the king's birthday was one of the few holidays that was universal throughout the empire. They began in the middle of the war to celebrate Washington's birthday. And for a long time to come, for the next couple of generations, Washington's birthday would be a preeminent holiday, as important for a while as the 4th of July. The phrases that you were quoting at the beginning of your introduction, first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen, is actually a borrowing of phrases that were used to describe the ideal monarchical leader. And the specific quote you used is from one of the major eulogies of on Washington's death. So in lots of symbolic ways, in rituals they established, revolutionary Americans fairly early on started to take monarchical symbols and apply them to George Washington. In other ways, they noted what he did, how he conducted himself, and they took his conduct as reflecting and embodying their ideals as Republican revolutionaries. To take just one example, after the Army left Boston, after the siege of Boston, and headed down to New York to defend New York City, the New York Provincial Congress, the Revolutionary Congress, issued an address to Washington, a formal address, to which he replied on behalf of himself and his fellow generals, his colleagues. And at one point, they noted what was very important to all the revolutionaries, Washington's consistent submission to civilian authority when he had been in Massachusetts. This would be a hallmark of his conduct all through the war. Washington, in his response, said to them in his formal address, "When we assumed the soldier, we did not lay aside the citizen." Now, this was a political gesture on his part that was of extraordinary importance. It was a signal, an indication that he did not intend to usurp or extend his authority beyond bounds. That was a major concern they had. They feared that a popular and successful general could become an all-conquering hero who could make himself into a tyrant. And he was telling them he would never do that. And that was lauded. It was quoted and lauded all up and down the continent.
Okay.
That was just one of the first and earliest political gestures he made that persuaded his audience that he would be the kind of Republican and nationalist revolutionary leader they wanted and needed, and that he embodied their highest ideals.
Okay, so this interrelationship then between Washington and his audience brings us to the second, and maybe we can do the second and the third significations together. The second being that Washington's sort of conscious, purposeful role in the process of shaping his heroic or Republican image, and the third being his inventiveness as a political actor and leader, for which you suggest he actually had a genius. Now, this seems to me a slightly different but related part of your title.
Yes, yes. First of all, his own involvement and activity and participation in the creation of his image was quite self-conscious, quite deliberate. I'm not saying it was hypocritical. I'm not saying it was phony or false play-acting. I think that on one level, he did intend to try to live up to those expectations. That doesn't negate that it was all deliberate and that he was quite aware of the audience that he was playing before and playing to. He knew what their standards were. He knew what their expectations were. He knew what it would take not only to win lasting historical fame for himself and as well as contemporary regard and honor, but he knew what it would take in order for them to entrust him with the power that he wanted and that he knew was necessary in order for him to exercise effective leadership. So he carefully tailored his public performance to match their expectations and standards and ideals. Now, I think that what has not been recognized very often until recently by historians and biographers of Washington is just how careful and scrupulous and self-conscious this performance was, and in addition, how skilled, how talented as a public and political actor he was. I mean, this was an era, the 18th century was an era of a very self-conscious and highly stylized public performances by political actors and leaders. And Washington was one of the great political actors, not only of the 18th century, but of all time.
How successful was he before his death, and how much was really predicated on his death to make him a hero?
Oh, he was lauded throughout his career, from the early on in the Revolution to the rest of his life, in Europe as well as America, as one of the great men of the age, one of the great men of all ages. His reputation began to be a bit diminished, a bit tarnished during especially his second term as president, because he, in fact, was beginning to become a partisan figure, and partisan politics was beginning to emerge, so that interestingly, the Democratic Republican critics of his administration were beginning to question his public image and to see flaws in the great hero. That was probably all to the good, as painful as it was to him, because that that meant that he wasn't going to be allowed, at least while he was in office, to become a public figure who was immune to criticism. That would have been a very dangerous development had that taken place. But he clearly wasn't immune. They vigorously began to attack him and more and more.
Now, you're suggesting something here I think we need to address, which is mostly we see our heroes as reluctant heroes, people who don't seek the limelight, but somehow because of their heroic actions are drawn into and become heroes, whether they want to be or not. In the case of Washington here, you're suggesting, first of all, that the public made a hero of him, but more importantly, that he sought it, that he worked hard to gain that heroic image. Is that what you're suggesting, and is this a cynical way of looking at it, or just a realistic way?
Well, I don't think it's cynical. I certainly don't mean it to be cynical. We've inherited from that generation, among other political values and ideals, the notions that power and ambition are very dangerous things, that a man or a person who is ambitious for political power is someone we should not trust, and that the ideal public figure, the ideal patriot, is someone who doesn't seek power or position or place, but is called to it and yields reluctantly to that public calling. It's an ancient ideal that harks back to the Romans and Cincinnatus, and for, it was no accident that Washington was thought of as a modern Cincinnatus. The problem with the ideal is that it doesn't take into account the psychological realities of human ambition. And in another sense, in another dimension of their political thinking, his generation was very shrewd and realistic, at least many of them were, about human psychology and about what motivated individuals. So it was recognized by some, by people like, say, John Adams, that you had to take into account the impulses, the drives, the ambitions of individuals, and then try to organize your government in such a way that it wouldn't allow too free a play, but it would actually derive some kind of benefit from those drives. In Washington's case, one of the things that got lost in the creation of the monument, the heroic mythic image, was the reality that he was a man of not just great abilities, but great ambitions. It's clear looking at his pre-revolutionary career that he was a young man of great talents and also great drives and ambitions, and he wanted place, position, and a share in power.
Okay.
One of the things he slowly learned and matured into was to understand that he was not going to get what he wanted unless he fit in with the dominant values, especially as they began to emerge in the pre-revolutionary era. A man who was nakedly ambitious for power was not going to be trusted with it.
Okay.
In fact, was going to be denigrated for it. So Washington, not cynically, but sharing those ideals and yet pragmatically understanding those ideals at the same time, knew how he had to comport himself in order to have a share in that sort of power.
All right, well put. We're running out of time, and I don't want to avoid the possibility here of your giving us a comment on something I know that's very important to you, unrelated to George Washington, is I know you've done a lot of work with the handicapped and the history of the handicapped and so on. You want to comment on that a little bit before we close about what you're doing and its importance?
Sure. Disability history is now emerging as a significant field of study by professional historians. A growing number of dissertations and books and articles are being produced in the field. It offers a number of important things, not only an understanding of a vast historical arena that's been neglected by historians up to now, but also a tool of analysis, a concept I think comparable to class, race, and gender that can help us understand even larger patterns of history. I don't think it's possible to understand either disability or what is usually, for want of a better term, called people who are normal. I don't think it's possible to understand either side of that without understanding the other. In the modern era, disability has been used as a way to help define what is normal. So I think the study of disability history has enormous ramifications.
Thank you, Paul. You've been listening to Paul Longmore, the author of The Invention of George Washington, and this is Talking History. On July 7th, 1799, 5 months before he died, George Washington signed his final will and testament. His estate included 317 slaves, making the founder of our nation one of the Republic's largest slaveholders. What did Washington ask to be done with his slaves upon his death? What were his final thoughts on the issue of slavery? Here to provide some answers to those questions in our op-ed of the week is Robert Dalzell, Ephraim Williams Professor of American History at Williams College. Dalzell is the co-author of George Washington's Mount Vernon, At Home in Revolutionary America.
Although Thomas Jefferson's moral struggle over slavery has lately gotten most of the attention, thanks to scholarly research, popular novels, and not least DNA evidence, he was not the only founding father to face a dilemma over slavery. They all did, and few of them thought longer and deeper about the issue than George Washington. Washington's feelings about slavery were rooted, as his convictions so often were, more in his own experience than in philosophical abstractions. Slavery was something he dealt with every day at home, at Mount Vernon, the place he loved better than any other on earth. In 1799, the last year of his life, the roll of slaves at Mount Vernon listed 317 names, making him one of the nation's largest slaveholders. Indeed, it is hard to imagine his life without slavery. As a young man, he had gone into debt to acquire slaves, knowing that they were the key to wealth and power in Virginia. He was assiduous about tracking down runaways and had his slaves whipped when he thought they deserved it. Then came the American Revolution, with its ringing commitment to freedom and equality. Whatever his feelings had been before, by the end of the war, Washington was writing privately of longing every day more and more to get clear of slavery. Yet he found that that was more easily said than done. At the very least, he decided, he would stop selling his slaves and thus avoid participating in what he called this traffic in the human species. In the same spirit, he took increasing pains to see that Mount Vernon slaves were well fed and provided with adequate medical care. But as a matter of pride, if nothing else, he also remained determined to make his plantation pay. And for that, he continued to depend on slaves, even as president. Which is where matters stood in July 1799 when, once again back at Mount Vernon, he sat down to make out his will, a document that turned out to be as significant as anything he ever wrote. To begin with, it stipulated that once he and Martha had died, his slaves were to be freed. It also provided for the support of those too old or too young to work, as well as for the education and training of the young. But Washington did not stop there. For in a real sense, the end of slavery would mean the end of Mount Vernon itself, and he knew it. He had no children of his own. However, he did have many nieces and nephews, and instead of leaving to Mount Vernon to one of them, as was customary to preserve family wealth, he divided his plantation among five different heirs and his other lands and possessions among many more. This, then, is where Washington's struggle over slavery had led him, to freeing his slaves, but also, finally, to dismantling his personal world, the world that slavery had made. It was a bold solution, conceived with all the clear-sighted, uncompromising determination that so impressed his contemporaries, and that makes Washington still, after all these years, such a commanding figure.
You've been listening to Robert Dalzell, co-author of George Washington's Mount Vernon, At Home in Revolutionary America, recently published by Oxford University Press. This is Brian LeBeau.